Now? All right. Sorry. I was back there just trying to come up with a sermon. You know, but the... I was back there just kind of going over things. I like to do that. And it was on the TV screen back there, but I wasn't looking at it until it was time. And actually, I took my hearing aids out today, so I couldn't hear it anyway. But I'm one of these guys, I keep on, I think I mentioned this morning, you know, my hips replaced, my knees replaced, I've had a shoulder replaced, they got to do the other one, and they keep going on. And I'm one of these guys, you know, as long as they keep coming up with great aftermarket parts, I just kind of get in line and say, what's next? What do you got? I'll probably need it. And right now, I'm just kind of waiting for artificial intelligence to be perfected a little bit, and I'll be in that line too. Well, this evening, if you would, turn with me to Genesis chapter 37, and I want to look at Joseph and his dream for his life. I think the Lord longs to give us all great dreams and great visions and great understanding in one way or another of why we're alive, what he has for us. Genesis 37. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And this is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report to them, to his father. And of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than the brothers, they hated him. They could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And he said unto them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. And there they were binding the sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose, and it stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves also, they stood around, and they bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said unto him, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall we indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Well, then he dreamed still another dream, and he told it to his brothers, and he said, look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars, they bowed down to me. And so when it was told his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him, and he said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envy him. But his father kept the matter in mind. Father, again, we thank you for the day of being able to come and sit before you, being able to set so many other things aside and seek your face. Lord, in the world in which we live, we've always needed you so much, but Lord, we need to hear from you more and more and more. Lord, that we would be not simply somewhat aware of the days in which we live, but it would truly affect the way in which we live. There would be a greater hunger for you and your word and your plan in our lives, that we would find ourselves finding it and fitting into it, seeing it fulfilled. So we thank you for your word. Thank you for Joseph. We ask as we look at his life tonight, you'd minister to every one of us. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, here, I'm sure that most of you, you're somewhat familiar with Joseph. But here tonight, just looking at kind of this area of this, he's actually a huge character in the book of Genesis. He has a huge part of it, more than Abraham, more than Moses, more than any other character. Joseph, he's a major character in the book of Genesis, and a great character in the history there, of course, of Israel. But something here when we look at this about Joseph, and one of the things that distinguishes him above many others is that Joseph, he was a man of vision. In the sense of his heart and life, God had a vision for him. And I don't think sometimes we realize, you know, how much of our spiritual heritage, when you pick up your Bible, is filled with dreams and visions. And they were proven ultimately with time to be of God as the passage of time happened. And these visions that people had, these dreams that God gave to so many in the Bible. Jacob dreamed. Joseph dreamed. you know, all of the patriarchs, or most all of them, they had either dreams or they had visions. Moses, Joshua, Judges, they all had personal revelations from God about their life, how God wanted to use them, what he had for them out yet for them. And basically all of them were incredible ones. Here we just have normal human beings. That's what they were at the time, as they just appeared like anybody else, just getting up like anybody else, functioning like anybody else, and yet they had these incredible things that God was revealing to them about their life. And to realize that God has plans for all of us. I don't believe God created anybody in his image and then just, oh, well, have a good life. See how you do. You know, enjoy your here time here on earth, but I have no plan for you. I have no dream for you. I have no vision for you. Just have a nice time, you know, or something. That's not God. He has a plan for everyone. And the more that somebody begins to seek and desire him within their life, the more that becomes aware to them. And here, so many in the Bible, you know, they whether the prophets through the Old Testament, major prophets, minor prophets, they dreamed dreams, they had visions, and the greatest of Bible characters. It was not uncommon at all for them. The book of Acts in the New Testament, there's many wonderful dreams that go on with it, and not just Paul, the apostles, but with many. Peter said at Pentecost in Acts 2:17, it says, come to pass in the last days, saith God, that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. And this is something that it was very common. And even through the book of Acts. And I think one of the greatest losses that there can be in life, you know, in life, there's a lot of tragic things that can happen to human beings. You can, you know, you can lose an arm, you can lose a leg, you can lose, you know, an eye, you can lose a job, you can lose a house, you can lose, you know, a loved ones. But I think one of the most devastating of all losses is when somebody's lost an eternal vision for their own life, why they're alive, why they exist. And they just kind of go from pillar to post through life, just muddling around, you know, like a little toy wind-up thing that just goes bumping into a wall and moves around until it goes this way and goes that way and finds some sort of sense of direction until it hits something else. And many people, as I watch them in life, they're kind of just wandering through it, just prodding along. And I think one of the saddest things, I look somewhat at, not to be judgmental of a generation, because that's painting with a very broad, you know, brush for sure. But so many of the millennials, these younger ones, they're just waiting, you know, the world owes them something. You owe me this, you owe me that, and I've got this coming by virtue of being alive, and you need to supply it and take care of things. And the tragedy of living their life, and so many, they have no vision. They have no direction. They have nothing that they're really seeking and working diligently for, even in the natural world, let alone the spiritual world. But Proverbs tells us that without a vision, people perish. And, you know, something there in life is that God wants to give us, you know, a vision for our life that is that's greater than any natural vision. That's just any, you know, natural things. You know, we have a lot of things today that, I know when I went through college, there was tests, I don't know if they give them any longer, but just kind of career guidance tests, whether you are one that, you know, you are different math and sciences or philosophy or different things and that you would be good at and that you just kind of work at and work towards. And so people, well, I guess I could be good at this, I should probably do that. And so they kind of head down that direction, but not having anything within them where the Lord is revealed, where they sat before God and taken a test there. God, why am I alive? Why did you make me? Why did you form me? Why did you fashion me? I'm sure we've all heard the old story of a fellow walking down a road and they're building a building there, and he comes up to one of the laborers and looks at him and he says to him, what are you doing? The fellow looks at him, almost disgruntled that he would even bother him, and he says, well, can't you see? I'm laying bricks. Well, okay. Walks down a little farther to the next fellow there, and he says, excuse me, what are you doing? And this, he looks up, and with a sense of pride and a smile, and he says to him, he says, I'm building a cathedral. And they're both doing the same thing, but one of them sees something far greater in what they're doing. What it is that they're all about, what's going on, and how sad that so many people, all they're doing, they're just laying bricks. They're just kind of doing stuff. there that while at the same time somebody else down the street and they're doing the same things. And yet there's a world apart between the two. One of them is sitting there, what are you doing? I'm putting a roof over my head. I'm feeding my family. I'm going to work. I'm doing whatever, you know, can't you see? And yet you could go to the next person, say, what are you doing? Oh, I'm building a life in the Lord. I'm building a family for God, for the kingdom. I'm building children. I'm building grandchildren. I'm pouring my life into them with a sense of this is why I'm alive. This is what I do. This is what God has put in front of me. And all of us, I don't care how young you are, how old you are. I mean, in the sense right now, you know, many of you, you may be, I'm not necessarily talking of in some thing like God wants to call you to go out and part rivers and get man out of heaven or water out of rocks. Who knows? But in the sense, though, of looking at who you are and what you're doing, that it seems so common as bricklaying. And yet at the same time, to look there and realize God put a sense of spiritual sense of eternity within it. Why am I doing this? What is it that everybody else up and down the street, the guy next door, two doors down, street up, street down, we're all laying bricks. We're all doing something as common as can be for some. But yet when others look around and say, no, there's nothing common about what I do. It's eternal. I will see it. I will see this cathedral built. I will see lives change. I will see whatever it is. I don't know how it's all fitting together. And a lot of it, I may not even know clearly what it is, but I have a vision. I have it. And there, and we find ourselves caught up in it constantly, praying about it constantly, looking at those around that are part of our own personal bricklaying world, so to speak, and saying, that's what I'm doing, and I want to pray about it. God, I want every brick I lay in somebody's heart or somebody's life or meal I put on a table, you know, or a thing that we go through to be something as a fulfillment of that. And so many people, again, they're just laying bricks. No greater sense at all. But Joseph, he ended up, he had a vision, he had a dream. And what it was, actually had two dreams. And here as we look at these dreams, they're quite interesting, of course, to look at. He sees, first of all, there's a harvest field. And there's he and his brothers. They're out bringing in the sheaves, so to speak, bringing in the harvest. And here as they bring it in, the brothers are all binding all their sheaves and putting them in and doing the work for it. And they're just doing the work, so to speak. And Joseph, though, who had a different heart, doing the same thing so much as his brother, but doing it differently. You realize there was something very, very different about Joseph there going on, that God could speak to him. He was interested. When God said something and showed something to him, he was swept into it. He was open to it, as wild as it may seem, as ridiculous as his own family would think of it, and absurd, even to others. But there was something that here in the dream, one of them, they all come in, and they're binding in their sheaves, and yet his brothers, he was the 11th of 12 brothers, the other brothers, their sheaves, they bow down to Joseph's sheaves. And his brothers, he tells them the dreams. Hey, guys, I got this wild dream. You got to hear this thing. We don't want to hear it. Come on, no, guys, really listen to it. It's really interesting. Well, obviously, they didn't think too much of it when they heard that. And it wasn't too difficult to figure that out. But then, with the second dream, the sun and the moon there and 11 stars, they bow down and pay honor to him. And then when his father hears that, he scoffs and he says, hey, listen, you think your mother and I, signifying the sun and the moon, that we're, and as well, we're going to bow down before you? And his brothers hated him. They were disgusted with this thing. And his father, though, he scoffed at him for it, he also, but he kept it in mind. He looked there and he says, there's something going on here. There's something happening. We got to watch this thing and see what it is that is happening. And here, as we see it, of course, it's not hard to interpret the dreams, and at least initially and on the surface. And that was very simply that among the family, there that Joseph, as time would go on, there that in his dream, it's a dream of an earthly dream. The fields, you know, there of harvest, bringing it in. It's a picture somewhat of wealth. All the boys kind of have this picture somewhat of a certain amount of wealth, but Joseph more so. and having greater sense of power or domination over the, you know, the fruits of the earth. Not hard to figure that one out. And then also the one there with the mother and father, the sun and the moon, and they're like even the parents. You know, they are going to do that, but and honor you, which of course was to happen, but something that nobody saw at the time. That it was far greater than even just that. Joseph, with time, was to be given a great position of power and authority over the earth resources, not just the families, but the earth. He didn't see it. It was way beyond the wildest of dreams. I mean, he couldn't, as absurd as this was, just with, you know, the sheaves bowing down in a family to him, maybe so, that's possible. But then, you know, if he would have even dreamed of what the real, you know, vision encompassed within the years to come, that would have been way beyond anybody's capacity to accept it or to grasp for it. And here, a picture of great power. Incredible power, the sun and the moon and the stars. You know, you were told in Genesis that the sun was given to rule the day and the moon the night, the rule the night. And here over the earth and to guide the earth, you know, and the stars there. I mean, the stars have long since through history been the way that people mapped out the earth. Navigation happened, guided things through life. And here the sun and the moon, this incredible eternal powers there in a sense, you know, set upon him. You know, there and guiding, you know, there the world later on through its tremendous time of famine that was to come upon it. Again, nobody could even dream of that at the time. It would just be if the Lord even told him a little bit more of it. I mean, then the guy would have been put in a loony bin or something. The guy would have been, you got serious mental problems, young man. This is not going to happen. But here within it. Though as we look at this and we watch Joseph and his brothers and his family as time goes on there, I mean, to realize this thing as it begins to materialize, it begins to happen. And as I said, far beyond anybody's imagination. But I believe God has that for us. I believe that there is something there that God for everybody. He's no respecter of persons. God doesn't dangle these characters in the Bible out before us and just say, well, wouldn't it be something like that for you? No, forget it. I like to tease you. I like it. I just think it's kind of fun to tease Christians, you know, and things, to play with you with these stories and maybe put wild, you know, imaginations. That'll never happen to you. No, I believe God has something in every life that is tremendous and has nothing to do with the magnitude of the task. You know, we think Billy Graham, when he gets to heaven, he's going to be rewarded so incredibly because it was believed that Billy Graham probably led more people to Christ than anybody else in history. And as an individual, we think, boy, when God rewards him, it's going to, you know, just stop the banquet for 3 hours as God starts listening to things. And, you know, and Billy is going to be rewarded for his obedience to his vision, to what God called him to do. It has nothing to do with how many people were reached. Which he never could have reached without all the age of technology and radio and TV and 1,000 people on the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association staff that were able to set up all of these things, coordinate events, and all of them, each as a task, a simple task. Billy Graham's is a simple task for somebody, a vision for his life. We tend, because we measure things differently than God does. God just looks at somebody's heart and their surrender and their obedience to do what it is that he puts in front of them when you do it. Jean's aunt, she worked for the railroad. She was just this wonderful old maid, never got married, the sweetest, godliest woman you ever met. And then when she retired from the railroad, she spent many years working for the Billy Graham Association for free. She's just a volunteer. She went in Minneapolis, their office, every day and sat. And all these people that would write in letters to Billy Graham, "Dear Billy," and she sat for years, thousands and thousands of hours, answering every one of the letters that was given to her personally on behalf of the Billy Graham Association. And I tell you, that woman, you know, that you don't know her name. No, you don't know anything about her. Nobody knows anything about her. Heaven knows about her. All these people that got a letter from her, something that she was praying, she just loved the Lord and it just radiated from her. And there she is as obedient as the Billy Graham was. because of what it is that God gave her. She didn't have any children. So, all right, then God give me children. And here they were. She never met them. But every time she sat down and wrote a letter, there she did what it was. And there I'm convinced one day, you know, when we're up there and she and her brought up, and I think Billy himself will stand up and applaud her. I don't know, who knows how this whole thing's going to come down, but in the sense of the heart, you know what I mean, of somebody there looking and applauding and say, here is somebody that their life was as consecrated and as surrendered to a vision and a dream, and she just had her bricks. Maybe, I don't know what her office was like. I was never in it. Where her desk was like. Maybe there was, 100 desks on her floor at the BGEA. I know they had a big building and a number of floors. And you would just go down and, another desk. Somebody else here. Somebody else there. Somebody else doing something. And yet there, when she went there and she sat down, she did what it was that God gave her and had a dream and a heart and a life for her job and the impact that she had upon people. Her mother, it was a family of 12 children. And Jean's aunt, she became a Christian before Jean's mother. And she was witnessing to her, sharing with her, all the time. And finally, Jean's mother wanted a watch. She was a young girl. There was a watch. And her sister, and she said, well, if you will go to this meeting with me, church meeting, I'll give you a watch. I'll get you the watch. She got her the watch. And she went to the meeting and got saved. And the thing is that here, you just look at these little things of somebody there that just looks at a life. And then I look at my mother-in-law and how many lives she impacted. What happened with her life? Direct result of her sister. Not only in her marriage, but her children, her grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. And she also, they asked her at church if she would take a ladies' Bible class. She said, I don't teach, I don't know how to do, but she just felt, well, I've got a lot of things in my heart. And so she started teaching, and she had a Bible class every week of 85 women she opened the Word to. And I'm sure that when Jean's aunt, she never saw this coming out of her life. She just saw there what the brick. Sometimes it just seems so simple as just a brick that's put in your hand, and to do it, whatever it is, the Bible class, the ushering, helping people. When I came on staff in 1971, a long time ago, at Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, and it started, you know the story, I'm sure many of you, and Chuck came, there's like 25 people, and as it grew. And there was a couple ushers there. One of them, his name is Roy Peebler. And Roy, he's this, and Herb Corwin, two guys there. And Herb, he looked like he was a retired bank executive. He was one of those, he came to church and he was an usher. And as an usher, though, he wore a suit. He was just dapper, retired like about maybe 80, 75. Good shape, though. And he dressed like he was going to the bank to run the bank. You would look at him, and he didn't really kind of fit in a whole lot, but he was an usher. And Herb Corwin, he had this way about him there that he had. And here we put up the tent, and he's in the tent, and you got these people coming in T-shirts and tank tops and flip-flops. But Roy would be there, and he'd have a bulletin, and some hippie or somebody come in, a young couple, and he'd walk right up to them. Hello, young man. Is this your first time? I haven't seen you before. Well, whatever they'd answer, and they said, I have just the seat for you. Just the seat. I think you'll like it. Come with me. Come with me. And he'd lead them down, and you would think he was just being ushered in to meet the president or something, the way he did it. But he absolutely loved seating people. You felt like royalty, the way he brought you down. And he says, how about this? And then he looked at people around. He says, I want to introduce you to somebody there that he just brought in. His name is John. Say hi to him. And he'd sit him down, and then he'd go back and get another person. Everybody knew Roy Peebler and Herb Corwin. Everybody. Here it is now. It's over, but 50 years later, I still think of them all the time. But what they did, I'm an usher. What do you know? I'm an usher. I tell you, Herb was laying bricks, eternal bricks. He was building cathedrals every day, every time he was there. And when somebody looks at their life in something that everybody else thinks is so common, it is. There's nothing common about life. There is nothing common about it for the child of God. There shouldn't be anything common about it. You know, and so I look at, you know, at my wife, who we have now, we've got 12 children, grandchildren, three children there, and, you know, it's three sons, three daughter-in-laws, they're awesome. And then we got 12 grandchildren, another grandchildren is due here in another few weeks. We have four great-grandchildren, and there, and my wife, I tell you, when she's around the grandchildren, I mean, she just loves, you know, just anything, whatever. You know, on one hand, I just hate her to go to the store because she can't walk by an aisle without seeing something that belongs to one of the grandchildren they haven't got yet. You know, she comes, what is all this stuff? You know, oh, this is for so, and this is, oh, look at this. It's going to be so cute on the mic. I didn't wait to see this thing. I said, okay. There goes my retirement again, you know, or whatever else. But it's, when somebody looks, they're why I'm alive. They're why I'm alive. I want them. I want to leave a legacy. I want them to know that their grandmother loved them every day of their life, loved everything, and just and loved Jesus and prayed for them every day that they were here. I was there for them. Joseph, he was a man there of you know, a vision. There was something God gave him for his life there that was to grow and grow and grow with time. But with that, the vision was to be tested, in a sense, by virtue. He had to be, in order for this vision to ever come about, he had to become a very virtuous man. There had to be something for this, you know, to happen. Here God gave him this vision, but Joseph was a long way from this vision to being fulfilled. There was a lot that was going to have to go on within his heart and his life before this was happening. We're all created for something wonderful and glorious. And to be made into the Lord's image, that's for sure with every one of us. But also at the same time, not just simply for Joseph, but for all of God's characters and all of us. It's to be a time where there's tough times. There's going to be tough times for the person that looks there and has a vision for their life. And that vision will be tested. In great ways. There are times of trial, times of testing, endurance, times of pain, times of struggle. They're part of life. And there's something there that is what makes a person what they are, what they're going to be, that God could put his stamp on them, say, made in my image. I remember years ago there was a watch, Timex. It takes a licking, keeps on ticking. Evidently, they couldn't take a licking because I don't think they're around anymore. I don't know. But anyway, and the ad for Ford Motor Company, you know, there's this big thing coming out, boom, you know, they're about it and something built Ford tough, bam. It's kind of this big thing goes down, you know, for it. And I mean, people, when they build something, anybody that's building, they want people to buy it. They want to know, has this been tested? What has it been through? What's its track record? What's its warranty? How much abuse can it take? You know, what can I put this thing through? You know, I used to be, I think, I don't know, Zenith or some TV, you know, the quality goes in before the name goes on or something, that this is going to, it's a proven thing. You want this product. Well, God's the same way. He's going to put somebody through some things within their life. And that person has got to be willing to be misunderstood, just to be misunderstood. That's a huge thing. We live in a world where there's a natural insecurity that we all have. We like to be liked. We want to be admired. We want to be respected. And when somebody would look at us, and I don't like you. I don't get you. And I don't even want to figure you out, you know, or something. That's where his brothers were. They were disgusted with him. He had to be willing to be misunderstood. He had to be willing there that his heart and his life and the things that drove him, they came from a different realm. They came from a different, you know, world, another kingdom. There was a driving influence in this life. He was, you know, you see these bumper stickers, not of this world, that goes around the Christian bumper sticker. Maybe some of you have them. But to really realize, I am not of this world. I'm not just not going to stay in this world and I'm going to go another one, but I am not of it. What makes me tick is I'm of another life. Another world, and they're willing to be thought of as bizarre or super fanatical, you know, or willing to be an outsider, willing to be a loner, being rejected. I'm one of these kids. I basically grew up in one home till I got married. I had the same friends all the way through grammar school, through high school, through college, fraternity. I wasn't a Christian until I became a junior in college. I had all these friends. And all these friends, some of them we grew up with. I mean, we had little clubs, all sorts of clubs. I remember one of the first one we had in the neighborhood, there's a whole bunch of boys. And we became blood brothers. I remember literally, you know, we pricked our thumb and we beat each one and we became blood brothers for life. We will die for one another or whatever else. And you realize that didn't go very far. You know, I don't recommend that anymore. You don't know what you'll get now. But but here, all these guys that grow up and we're in car clubs together. Car clubs were big in the 60s. And I was, you know, growing up and everything to be cool and to fit in. Fraternity life, where literally you go through this and you are brothers for life. They put you through so much that you are so connected by the time you have been brought into this fraternity that you've been through Hell Week, you know, with them. And you have, like, you've been in a trench together in the war or something that now we will die for one another. And I had all these friends that were, you couldn't ask for greater friends until I became a Christian. And I began to be bold and speak about it. And tell, you know, people, one of the things that I was so insecure, so insulted one time, I met a fraternity thing. And I met this fraternity thing and I knew God wanted me to share with my friends. And I wasn't doing it, but I met a fraternity party. And there's a band playing and people dancing out there. And somebody comes up to me and asked me if I wanted a drink. I said, no, thank God was showing me you don't need that anymore. And he said, what do you mean? I said, no, I'm okay. And so he keeps grilling me. I'm just kind of, oh, you know, I didn't know, I'm just, no, I don't need it. Or whatever else. Well, why? You know what? And so I said, well, maybe the Lord wants me to say something. So I said, well, I'll tell you, I became a Christian. And before I could get anything else out of my mouth, he stops. What? And he starts screaming. There's a party. There's a band playing. People are dancing. He starts screaming, hey, everybody, hey. People, he's screaming. He's crazy. And the band stops. People are dancing. He pulls a chair, puts it out in the middle of the floor, and he says, guess what, everybody? McClure's become a Christian, and he's going to preach to us. He pulls the chair out. He says, go for it, man. Preach to us. And I'm just sitting there. He's drunk. And I walked away, humiliated. I was afraid. I was something I was made a fool out of. I was somebody that was mocked. And I'm sitting there just, I mean, almost like instead of being somebody there that knew how to handle it or had the maturity or had something to realize that this was, you know, an opportunity that I was entirely immature and unprepared to handle. But yet there when somebody looks and do they have that in them? There, then when they realize, I don't care what the cost is. I don't care what it is I've got to go through for God to fulfill what he has me here for. What anybody thinks of it. And God has a way of testing this. It's quite common. Well, he put Joseph through the ringer, you know, with this. He put Moses through a ringer. You look here, Moses, he gets a dream. He gets a vision. Stephen tells us how that Moses, when he was 40 years old, on how that he believed how God would, by his hand, deliver the children of Israel. God gave him a sense of why he was alive. And there's a plan. Well, he goes out to try to do it on his own. He crashes and burns. Because there he was, you know, God had a plan for him, but Moses was far from the virtuous man yet that he wanted to make out of him. He had to drive him out there in the wilderness, have him run for his life. He'd killed an Egyptian, buried him in the sands, and now there as he kind of runs for his life. The next thing you know, I mean, after 40 years go by, and God keeps reducing him down. To a man there that he was willing to, as he forsook all the treasures and pleasures of Egypt and chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy that. And as God is separating him and purifying him and preparing him, because here was a man that God was to take when he's finished with him. And he's ready that he is going to literally use to rule the course of nature for 40 years. Like nobody has ever done. Ever dreamed of doing. Water's going to come out of rocks. Man is going to come out of heaven. Plagues are going to come on men and animals. Rivers are going to turn to blood. Lice are going to come. I mean, he's going to have command of heaven and earth. Resources. Unbelievable to anybody, but to be there a man. There with all of this, there within him, he was to be trained and he was to be equipped and he was to be humbled. in a man that would prepare him for the glory of God that was to be poured into his life and not be swept by it away when it came. Somebody there who knew who he was and what he was about when the time came, all right, now the vision. And then Moses, we're told later on, about Moses, you know, he says that he was the meekest man on the face of the earth. The meekest man on the face of the earth. You know, and I used to think about that all the time, and people would even almost make humor about it. I said, now you got to realize, Moses also was the one who wrote that about himself. You know, that, and people would say, well, whatever, you know, but with it. But there's no question to me, he was the meekest man. He was the meekest, absolutely he was the meekest man to me. If Moses would have been used at 40 years old and the dream would have happened, the vision would have happened, the world would have changed, the children of Israel would have been set free, and, you know, the water rivers would have opened, the water out of rocks, man out of heaven, plagues came, and all this happened. And here, had that happened when he, at the beginning, I suppose, you know, if you'd have interviewed Moses, if CNN and ABC and all of them would have been there, you know, as he came through the Red Sea and asked him, now, how did you do this? You know, tell us the story. Now, we're told about Moses. He was educated in all the wisdom and the knowledge of the Egyptians. He was an extremely smart man. Training. He was mighty in word and deed. Word and deed, that's quite a combination there. You know, somebody there. It's one thing, sometimes you meet people that are mighty in deed. I mean, they're heavyweight champions of the world and incredible wrestlers or something. Mighty indeed, but they're usually not the most eloquent. Sometimes you meet silver-tongued orators that are incredible, but they can't back up their words. Moses could say something and you didn't mess with him. He was mighty in word and indeed. He was an incredible human being. It would have been easy maybe if it happened at 40. He said, well, how'd you do that? Well, I don't know. We're also told he was exceedingly handsome. Well, I don't know. My good looks probably opened some doors for me. I'm also pretty smart, you know, clever, I'm very wise, and I'm educated in all the wisdom and knowledge of the Egyptians, and I'm tough. I'm built tough. I can take a licking, and I took it, and, you know, he could have been filled with himself, but you interview him at 80 years old when he brought him through the Red Sea, and he brought all this. I think if they'd asked him, how did you open that river? How do you get water out of rocks? How do you get man out of heaven? How do you get quail out of the sky? He'd look there and say, I haven't the faintest idea. I was the most blown away person that ever you ever saw when this happened. I was more blown away than anybody else. I have no idea. God just said, stretch out that rod. I was shaken. I stretched it out. The river opened. I don't know how to open a river. I don't know if I could ever open one again. God said do it. So I did what I was told. I didn't care about anything any more than just doing what he wanted me to do. I'd given up on everything else. He brought me to the end of myself. For 40 years, I thought I was somebody. In the last 40 years, I was absolutely nobody. Little more than my wife's husband, employed by my father-in-law, shoveling sheep around a desert, wondering what in the world went wrong. And then God came and said, Moses, it's time. I've got a vision for your life. You think you're 80, you think you're old. It's just beginning, buddy. Now I'm going to tell you what I want you to do. And I want you to do it. What have I got to lose now? It's all gone. And he did it. You look at David, you know, a little kid there, you know, young as all these boys, bigger, stronger, and he, and here, you know, the story, you know, Samuel is sent to replace Saul as king there, you know, over Israel. He'd been disobedient. God's done with him. Samuel is sent to the house of Jesse there to anoint one of his sons to become king there in Saul's place. And Jesse arrives there and he's waiting. The oldest, the biggest, Eliab comes out. He's brought before him and he looks at him and he says, oh, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And he's about to do it. And here God takes Samuel aside. Samuel, what are you doing? I didn't tell you to do that. I told you I'd point him out to you. I didn't point this guy out. And then he told Samuel a simple thing. He says, you know something, Samuel? Man looks at the outer countenance. God looks at the heart. I don't care how big he is. I don't care how old he is. I don't care how strong he is. I don't care what a good leader you think he'd be. I want to know, is he somebody that I'll have in the palm of my hand that will trust me when I anoint him and will do what I have for him? And he ends up one son after another until he goes through all the boys. And then he asks his dad, are there any, do you have any more? It's not easy. And Samuel says, well, there's one more. It says in the King James there that, but he's the youngest. In the Hebrew, it's the least. If you wouldn't take any of these kids, believe me, he's not going to do the job. He said, get him in here. I'm not going to sit down until he's here. He got the memo. God looks at the heart of somebody. And when he gets a hold of that, next thing you know, he turns in to be the greatest king the world has ever known, I think. Not only Israel, but I suppose the greatest king in history would have been from Israel in God's terms and the greatest in Israel. But here when somebody looks at their life, and here it's sown, same thing with Joseph. He's young at this time. He's immature. He's untested. You know, he's almost spoiled in one sense. He's his father's favorite son of his favorite wife. And here his brothers, you know, they're looking at this thing and the idea, you think we're going to bow down to you? Really? No. Absolutely not. Their brother, and then the mom and dad, hello. You think so? Nobody saw any reason whatsoever to bow down, and there was no reason. None. Absolutely none at the time, other than a dream. That's all it was, a dream. That it was absurd to everybody else's thinking about it. And yet that's what God starts with. That's what he takes. And here, you know, he's taking Joseph. And now the work begins. There one day his brothers, who hated him for his dreams and hated him because his father loved him so much and were jealous of him, and they see him coming out and they realize, here's this dreamer. We can't take this kid anymore. And first they decided, we're going to kill him. They were just, we can't do that. And then they saw a band of Ishmaelites come along there and they said, let's sell him. Kid's worth something. Let's see what we can get for him. They sell him into slavery. His brother, wait a minute, this isn't part of the dream. This does not fit in. Wait a minute, yeah, you can't sell me. Oh, yes, we can. Watch us. They sell him to these Ishmaelites. And then the Ishmaelites take him down to Egypt. And then they said, we don't know what to do with him really either. We got a deal on him. We can probably, the market might be pretty good in Egypt. A guy named Potiphar is interested in him. Hey, we can make a buck here. So they sell him to a guy named Potiphar. I mean, it's bad enough to be sold into slavery. Now he's a used secondhand slave, you know. And there, I mean, that's pretty low. Wait a minute, what are you doing? This does not fit in my dream. And then Potiphar's wife begins chasing him around and tests him morally, tests him there, and here, there, and down there. But Joseph said, "I can't do such a thing before God." God is testing him. Virtue is going in. And then there, when Potiphar's wife chases him around, she's going to have him no matter what. He has to run, leaves his coat behind, and you know the story. She is so upset with him, she tells her husband, Potiphar's, that he was chasing her. And so he probably knew what was really going on, but he had to do something to save the look of his wife's appearance or something. So he has him thrown in prison. What in the world? How can this fit in with a dream, with a plan? This is not part of the plan. And while he's in there, because he was a virtuous man, he worked hard. He gains leadership within the prison. There's something about this guy that's different. He didn't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on, but it didn't change the virtue in the man. What he was, no matter what. Whether he saw his life fitting together or working, it was, and he did it. And here then, finally, after being in there some time, Pharaoh, he gets upset with a couple of his servants, has them thrown in prison. And there is they're thrown, in prison. The couple of these guys, they have dreams. One of them is a butler, the other is a baker. And they're in there, and they hear that, hey, there's this guy, he interprets dreams here. He's incredible. And so the butler goes to him. He says, you interpret, yeah, tell him what you're dreaming. See if the Lord will tell me what it is. And he said, well, I got these three branches of vines there, and I squeezed the grapes off the branches there, and I put them in the cup and took them to Pharaoh. And he said, basically, the three branches are 3 days, and taking the grapes there and the glass of wine to Pharaoh, you are going to be taken out, you'll be freed from the prison, and Pharaoh is going to restore your job back to you in 3 days. Well, the butler hears this. Oh, I like that interpretation. That was good. And he said, well, I had a dream too. He says, well, what was your dream? maybe I can help you with it. And he says, well, mine is kind of like his. I've got these three containers there of breadstuffs that I'm taking to Pharaoh. But on the way, the birds of the air, they came and they ate it up. And he says, well, your dream is almost very, very close to his, with it. Or both, it is 3 days as well. There, what's going to happen? And he says, in 3 days, you're going to get out. But it's a little different. He's going back to his job, and Pharaoh, though, he's actually going to hang you and then give your body to the birds of the air to eat. But you're free. You're leaving here. And it happens. Joseph tells the butler, he says, when you get out, tell Pharaoh about me? He forgets all about it. A couple years go by. And then Pharaoh has a dream, and he can't dream, and he can't handle it. He can't figure it out. The butler, hey, you know, when I was at we had that little mix-up between us. You threw me in prison. Well, I was there. There was a guy who interpreted my dream, told me exactly what was going to happen. Well, get him in here. And then he interprets Pharaoh's dream. He said, well, there's 7 great years coming. I don't know he's getting into it now, but 7 great years and 7 years of famine. And he says, Pharaoh, you have to, in the interpretation, you've got to prepare the world for a great famine that's going to come across the face of the earth. And you've got to set things aside and build it up so that when the 7 bad years come, the world can survive. Pharaoh said, that's it. And he says, you just got to go get yourself somebody you can trust with a job and start saving it, setting aside all the crops for the future. Pharaoh says, who better to do it than you who interpreted? And all of a sudden, the dream. Next thing you know, here he is. He's catapulted into becoming prime minister. The most powerful man in the earth gives him his chariot, gives him men, gives him orders. Whatever this man says, it is now law. He now is going to rule the planet. Whatever comes out of it, it's under his control. And then he ends up, of course, going and does all this. Meantime, years go by. He was 17 and a half years old when the dream, that is going on, we're told in Genesis. 37 and a half years old, his brothers, now they've run out of food up in Canaan. Their father looks at the other boys. He says, what are you guys sitting around here staring at each other for? Go down and take care of this. It's so funny because my dad used to say stuff like that. There's 3 boys in my family. What are you doing? And my dad would look at them and say, what are you boys doing staring at each other? Get out and do your lawn jobs or something like that. And the dad says, you get down there and get some food, trade for it. And they get down there. In the meantime, Joseph now, he speaks the language, he's refined, he's prime minister, got all of this around him. He recognizes his brothers don't recognize him. But he puts them through a series of tests. We don't have time for him, but as he puts them through the tests, to see have they changed at all. And the very one who wanted him to let him die and then turn against him, they stood there because now he sets up this whole thing to get the other brother down that wasn't there with him, his brother. And as he sets the whole thing up, he puts a bunch of money and stuff in their pouches to go back and silver and stuff. And here, then he chases them down. You say, no, he didn't do this. And so finally he gets them to where he forces them, but they come out, and one of them said, he says, take me there. We lost a brother once. We can't let that happen to my father again. And now the very one that was a ringleader in his destruction almost before, he's testing. They've grown up. They've changed in the last 20 years somewhat. And here then he breaks down and he weeps and he reveals himself to him. I'm Joseph, your brother. And here then he ends up, not only they send for the rest of the family, Pharaoh gives him the land of Goshen. He says, here, the famine's there, but just come down, bring your family down. They can have anything and everything that they need to get themselves on. And Joseph did save the family. And they bowed down to him for a reason, because he had virtue. Not just vision, there was now a reason. Look at what he has done. Look at what the man that he is. And God looks at us and he says, I want to give them a vision, but I want to test it. I want them to look there and say, I mean this. It's something there's the greatest honor in the world. We look at these lists of people. I could go on character after character. I love character studies. It's my favorite thing. It's endless in the Bible. What he does, whether with Esther, what he does with Hannah, what he can just go on and on. Men, women, young people, all the way through. He gives them, puts something on their life, gives them a vision, gives them a call, and then he refines them. And he builds them. And then when it happens, he says, now the world's yours. And God, that's what he does. Because when somebody there, they become, they all right, God, test me in my neighborhood. Test me with me at the office. I'm willing to be lonely. I'm willing to be rejected. I'm willing to be laughed at. I'm willing to be, the weird religious, fanatic, spiritual Christian or whatever, that has morals and has values and has something and, whatever it is. I'm willing to stand up and bear your name. You went to the cross for me. Where can I go for you? And that's virtue. And when that happens, you get vision and virtue together, you've got value. You've got somebody there, that Joseph there, is all this happened. All this went through. At the time, seems so meaningless. Seems so, how could this ever be part of this dream and a vision of life? But when somebody learns just how every day to get up and lay bricks, they can get up every day, but as they lay it, they're building a cathedral. They go to work, they're building a cathedral. They're looking at people's lives around them. And God, give me my office, give me, or what's left of it. One of the things that's happened to me with this whole COVID thing, I'm one of these guys for years and years. I've traveled about 10,000 miles a month on the average. All over the world doing what I do. And all of a sudden, it just shut down. Gone. Overnight, when this whole thing happened. Airport shut. Everything just stops. And we're sitting there at home, and next thing you know, I look out and I notice my neighbors. We've lived in this home 18 years. They all know. They know we're Christians. But we've never really talked to them much. And we found ourselves, they're all walking their dogs and taking a walk. Nothing much to do. And we're looking out there and seeing all this, and next thing you know, God, show me. I've got all these people. I know them. I've never really been a witness. I think I'm a decent Christian witness to them, but in the sense of any boldness. We find ourselves, I take all their names, not all of them, 16 of them, that I felt like doors are a little bit open with, and pray about it in some conversations, and pray every day. Not only we have our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, all of this, but we are in by name. Maybe today, when I'm going to walk by, and I'll be able to ask them, how are you? Anything I can pray for you for? And maybe a year ago, they'd have mocked me. I got a Hindu family next door and a Muslim family. And all these other, people around a various collection of the world in one sense. And yet, they're nice people. And here as they walk by and find myself looking and realizing they're right in front of me. These people, God, you've trusted me and my neighbor. I'm to be the light. Jesus said, you're the salt of the earth. If the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It's henceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden under the foot of men. You're the light of the world. A city that is set upon a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, that it giveth light to all that are in the house, and let your light so shine before men. They may see your good works. Glorify your Father who is in heaven. And here the Lord looks, and I found myself, to tell you the truth, ashamed. Here I'm salt and light to all these people, and I haven't been. I'm just a nice guy that happens to be a Christian, but haven't really taken the next step of laying a brick in their life. And then whatever the consequence, okay. I don't care. What it is, but to see doors open. And here, there was, something that they ended up, the brothers and the mom and dad, they bowed down to Joseph, their ultimate, not because he was the greatest financial wizard. He was the greatest athlete. He was the greatest guy that ever came down the pike. They bowed down simply because he was a great man. When somebody looks and says, that a person is a great human being. And Jesus, the Lord loves taking Moses, making his name great. He took David, made his name great. They took Joshua, made his name great. Jesus, we should long to be great. Jesus, he said, he that is greatest among you is to be your servant. To look there at all these people, and Joseph there, he was great in his family because he served them. Even when they wanted to kill him and sell him, he served them. And finally, when it all comes together and you look, Moses served. All people that it isn't something they're great because of, there's some in the human worldly thing they're great. They're great because in the economy of God, they're great. And, and when we look there and say, God, can I provide for people like Joseph did? Can I deliver people like Moses? Can I help establish people in their lives like David did? Can I exhort people like Elijah did? Can I intercede as Esther did? And God put me around people that I can help transform their lives. And you've got them all around you. They're all around you. And they're just waiting. Whether they don't know they're waiting, but they're waiting for you, waiting for me to stand up and to be odd, to be misunderstood, to be somebody there that God, give me a vision for my heart, give me a vision for my life, give me a vision for those that are around me. And it may just start with getting a watch for your little sister. It may just be a cup of cold water in his name that opens the door. But when we look there, give me a vision. I'm tired of laying bricks. I want to build a cathedral. And that's when I think the Lord says, all right. Same building materials, different heart, and you'll build one. Father, thank you for your word. Lord, thank you for the call on us. Lord, as we just look at the world, or we look at Modesto, or we look at our little cul-de-sac, or we look at just those that walk by our door that we wave at, hello. But Lord, I pray that you would give to us a vision, a dream, that whatever it is that's around us, to find the brick nearest to us, it's the most accessible thing, the simplest thing right in front of us, and then take it. That child, that grandchild, that great-grandchild, that niece, that nephew, those neighbors down the street that have known all sorts of things about us, but when we can just tell them, I hope you're okay. You're on my heart. Can I pray for you? And Lord, to see what doors may open. I know with myself, I haven't had one person laugh at me amazingly or reject it, but they have things. Lord, help us to be that person that you could trust us with the gospel. You could trust us with salt and light, and we would do well with it. We would be virtuous with it. We thank you for your love. In Jesus' name, amen.